Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about Russia. And our guest for the program is Nadia Ajkikina. She's a journalist, leading activist on gender issues in Russia. She's here visiting the campus to take part in a conference looking specifically at women in Russia today. It's sponsored by the Russian, East European, and Eurasian Center at the U of I. And we're pleased to have her here with us this morning to spend a little bit of time talking about some of the challenges faced by journalists today and to talk about women in Russia today. Let me tell you a little bit more about her. She's been a columnist and a reporter for a number of Russia's leading newspapers. She currently teaches journalism at Moscow State University, where she taught courses concerning gender issues in the media, the contemporary press, and also creative reporting. She has a PhD from the Faculty of Journalism at Moscow State. She's the author and editor of 12 books in Russian and English on women's issues, culture, and journalism in Russia. Also, currently, she serves as the executive secretary of the Russian Union of Journalists, and also director of the Center for Creative Programs. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So at any point here, folks who are listening and want to join the conversation, they may do that. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. I'm very happy to be here in Urbana-Champaign. It's not my first visit to the States, but it's my first visit to Urbana-Champaign, and I admire my staying here in warm weather, much warmer than in Moscow.
Yeah, well, it's a little warm even for us this time of year, so as long as you're enjoying it, that's good. One of the things that I wondered, it's kind of a general question, but supposing that we went around Russia and we put together a representative group of people, some older people, some younger people, city people, country people, men, women, and we asked them, if you consider all of the ways that Russia has changed in the post-Soviet era, would you say that you are better off than you were for those people who were around before 1989? Are things better? Are they worse? Or does it depend on what it is you're talking about?
You know, I think it's a very American question, this or that. We Russians maybe not complicate, but we do not think in so exact definitions. Mm-hmm. And just now, these months since this spring, all in Russia discuss perestroika lessons and perestroika experience and what had really happened to us, because it's important to understand even for us Russians. And I should say that Russia is very big and very different, of course. There are big cities. There is Moscow, which is like a separate state inside Russia. There are small towns. There are big cities. There are industrial regions, regions of oil and gas and so on. And people also are very different. And not only rich and poor, there are people of different interests. And what we really got and what is, I think, the real achievements. Everybody knows that, probably maybe everybody knows that free media is one of the most obvious achievements of perestroika. But I should say that this opportunity to choose this free choice, which was very exotic and unusual for Soviet people for decades, and even for Russians many years ago, it's our real practice. And it's not easy practice, because choice means responsibility. Not everybody in Russia is ready to be responsible for his or her choice. That's a problem. Of course, many people, men and women, had different opportunities to enter businesses, to realize their ambitions, for example. Definitely people received the opportunity to travel and to see outside world. We lived in a closed society for decades and unfortunately had very surrealistic ideas and perceptions about universe. We understood ourselves as unique. Now, I think we study to understand ourselves as normal people of the beginning of 21st century, which should be and must be responsible for our life, for our economy, for our domestic affairs, and so on. Of course, I think that people from younger generation, they got more benefits from perestroika, of course, than mm-hmm. people from elder generation, and it's also a psychological question. Many people really suffer. Many people lost their incomes during bank crisis and different economical conditions. But I should say that people try to do their best to be responsible for their lives. And I understand this feeling as maybe the most important achievement, that we can make difference in our country, in our fate and in fate on our country.
Mm. Well, I appreciate the fact that Russia is a very large country and that you have, I remember
like
how many
states.
Time zones there are. It's a very large country and the people are very diverse. And it's a very I know that I asked a difficult question because the answer, I'm sure, depends upon who you are, and that people who are younger perhaps are optimistic about the future. Old age pensioners may not be because they don't feel financially secure, and maybe they're not sure if the changes were good. Some people got rich, other people didn't. So it really I understand that it really depends on who it is you are. How it is you're going to answer that question? Are things better than they were? Having said all that, I guess, well, maybe if you ask it this way, who do you think has done the best?
It's also a good question because different people did best in different ways. Hmm. Some intellectuals, yes, they did. They could realize their fantastic ideas they never expected during stagnation time. Many people got opportunity to be involved in different issues previously forbidden for them. For example, women journalists. Of course, during Soviet time, it was impossible to for male journalists to go to war, for example, or to report from war, and to report even on high politics, international affairs, or high economy. Now it's everyday practice, and I should say that women journalists penetrated those male provinces and made a real difference. This is one example. And women's war reporting is the most interesting this time in Moscow. I should compare it with Italian experience or maybe Spanish experience, so it's not only Russian example, but it's clear. Many women penetrated business sphere, but I should say that the main decision-making positions and high businesses are occupied totally by men because our privatization was very strange. It was not real business. It was like division of former state-owned property. Of course, between male directors, former party leaders, and so on. It's well known in Russia.
Yes, I think it's probably well known outside of Russia, too.
Yes, I'm glad to hear it.
These are the people that we call the oligarchs.
Yes, and there are no female oligarchs, and only 3% of Russian women entrepreneurs belong to this high level of economy, unfortunately. But in small and medium and family businesses, there are very many, and they are very active, for example. So it differs.
Yeah. I'm sure that for someone who does the kind of work that you do, one of the things that you or perhaps other people, college professors, would be interested in would be an opportunity to more freely practice your craft in an atmosphere of greater freedom and openness. I would also expect that for a lot of people, for them, the thing that they would have been looking for was an improvement in their material standard of living. For them, being able to read whatever book they wanted might not have been as important as what kind of a car they might have, or what kind of apartment they might have, or how well they could live, or what kind of future their children might have. And I think that initially there might have been some disappointment among people, sort of average people, about the fact that it didn't work out that way. Some people got rich, but it was only a handful of people. And particularly women, I think, according to what I have read, that their economic, they actually, in terms of their economic potential, their earning power, they've really lost ground over the last 15 years. Now, maybe in the last couple of years, things have gotten better. But overall, in that period, there has been a real decline in their earning power.
Yes, it's a very important question because I should say that Russia maybe is a strange country because, first of all, because of very limited material opportunities for people for decades. Russians and Soviet people used to live in very poor conditions, poor conditions, and used to live mostly focused on ideas. And perestroika In the economical dimension, it was a very poor time. We had no enough goods. We had no enough food. We have no enough different merchandises. But it was a time of great inspiration and great hopes. And all country lived with this great idea of better future. And this idea united university professors, policymakers, workers, farmers, artists, everybody. I remember this time very well, and it was really emotional and very important time of our life. But now when market came and people used to look at goods, and now we have, like in the United States, we have maybe the same number of goods in our stores and Moscow, maybe you know that Moscow is a very expensive city now to live. Right. And all facilities are available, not for everybody, but for few people. And it's interesting how people try to understand, to find themselves among this huge amount of things, because it's not Russian tradition to think about cars or to think about apartments, about clothes. It was something not so important for decades, at least for Russian intellectuals. Now it is important. And what about women? Women, of course, are more dependent on everyday practices, and they were more dependent. And during Soviet time, they were protected by the state as a part of population, as a huge amount of women. Of course, there were subsidies for children, for young mothers, for mothers with many children. There were real subsidies, so women felt protected. And socially secure. Their children got free education, went to free kindergarten, and so on. Now women lost this, and many of them suffer. Of course, not everybody entered into market economy, and not everyone is successful in it. But I think it's dependent not only the state. I think the main problem of Russia is that freedom and market were not conquered in fighting. We got everything from above during Gorbachev time, including freedom of expression. And this fact creates many problems, psychological problems, first of all, because people were not prepared for this. People used to live under total control, but under total protection. How to be responsible for ourselves, living conditions and so on. And I think that Russian state could do more for families and for women because market is not developed enough. We have no charity strategies and charity practices. So I should say that not long ago, new initiatives appeared in Russia. It was common activities conducted by our government, Ministry of Health and Social Development, and some NGOs to create some strategies of social partnership to protect women and families and children and so on. So we lost this social democratic protection for women and families, of course. But Russian men suffer as well. They cannot find their own place in this market economy very often because if they didn't participate to in oligarch's place, it's very difficult to establish serious business by your own. You should participate in some group activities and so on. If you have no original started money, how come? So it's a serious problem. But I think it will be resolved, and first of all, resolved by activities of social, of civil society and different social active groups, which are in the very beginning now. But I think it's a good perspective for Russia.
Let me introduce again our guest, and we have a caller we'll get right to. Nadia Ajgikina. She's a journalist, leading activist on gender issues in Russia. She teaches journalism at Moscow State University. She's also executive secretary of the Russian Union of Journalists. And she's here visiting the campus to take part in a conference looking at women in Russia today. It's sponsored by the Russian East European and Eurasian Center at the U of I. She will, in fact, be giving the keynote address this afternoon at 5:30, talking on the subject, Women's Place in the Market Space. least 20 years after Perestroika. We're glad to have her here. Questions are welcome. We have a caller we'd bring into the conversation here. Someone on our toll-free line. Someone listening in Eureka. We'll go there. Line 4. Hello.
I have two questions, please.
Sure.
First one. Last night on a Chicago radio station, I heard two reporters who were Washington Post report journalists in Moscow describe a phenomenon which it seems to be a certain segment of the population is longing for Stalin and authoritarianism. Could your guest either confirm or deny that situation?
Is the question? I'm looking at her. So I wonder if is the
I'm
question.
Sorry, I'm sorry. There seems to be there is a longing for a return to something like Stalin as a leader, and a very strong support for some kind of authoritarianism, a return to authoritarianism. Would your guest be able to comment on that,
what do you
please?
Think about it?
Thank you for this question. Yes, there are different trends in Russian society today. Russia is not united as during last Soviet time when we had official propaganda, small dissident movement, and lots of passive liberal-oriented intellectuals in between. We have different trends, different parties, different groups, including fascists, nationalists, right and left radicals, and so on. And of course, some people would really like to restore image of Stalin. And restoration of statues of Stalin take place in some Russian cities. For example, it was very hot discussion in our media in Siberia, in Yakutsk. It was one of the centers of former Gulag during Stalin time. Mayor decided to restore a monument to Stalin. Those trends exist, and I think, and our analysts say that it's a sort of reaction for this poverty and lack of real social strategies of our government, a sort of reaction from some people, mostly former military officers, mostly people from elder generation, those who really lost some privileges, respect from people, and feeling of stability. But I should say that also some youngsters join those groups because some youngsters do not feel protected as well. They do not feel that they, for example, would definitely receive free education and so on. So they participate in those movements. But I cannot say, Russia, as I said, is not united. It's very different. There are different trends. And I cannot say that this idea to restore Stalinism or totalitarianism is dominating in our society.
I just want to ask a follow-up and then a second and I'll hang up.
Sure.
So you would say that it exists among a relatively small segment of the population, and my second question is, it was stated last night on this talk show that Putin was elected with about 70% of the vote. I guess my question is, does he still have a relatively widespread support among the populace? Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, really, President Putin still has huge support. I cannot give you exact figure now because it differs every month and maybe every week. But I remember that a month ago we had an independent poll, and it was very interesting that Russians did not trust to Russian government. Rate was approximately 5%. Didn't trust to Russian military service, the same figure. Didn't trust to local authorities or to Russian parliament or to other state institutions. But they trusted to the president, and figure was approximately 16-something percent. And it was interesting, there was a special poll devoted to priorities of journalists. You know that journalists are the most critical-oriented part of population by origin. It's our duty to criticize, to be very skeptical about everything. And I should say that percentage of popularity, this rating of President Putin, it was also approximately 50%. Which is really high.
One of the things that I certainly wanted to ask you about, give you the opportunity to talk a little bit about, would be some of the challenges faced by journalists, because there certainly has been criticism of Mr. Putin for a contraction of press freedom and for dealing harshly with people who have criticized him and his policies. Mm. And I came across some comments here involving some Russian journalists One of the people that was quoted was apparently the man who is the secretary of the Russian Union of Journalists, Mr. Kuchantov, mm-hmm. Pavel Kuchantov. Mm-hmm. And his comment was that while his feeling was that the Russian media was not being censored, however, he thinks that there is actually a less free flow of information. There's less information available. How difficult is it, or is it difficult to be a journalist today in Russia?
I think to be a journalist is difficult anytime. Pavel Gutyontov is my close colleague and friend. I know him for 20 and something years, and it was difficult for him, for example, during Soviet time to publish honest and sharp investigations, as he did, but he managed, even mm-hmm. during Soviet time. And I should give you a figure, a very sad figure, that since 1991, since start of Russian market and independence from socialist ideology, 250 journalists were killed in Russia, not only in Chechnya or other wars, but mostly in regular life because of their professional activities, investigations, and so on. So it's really dangerous profession. And journalists are really on the front line everywhere in Russia and in many countries as well. Of course, it's exciting to be a journalist. It's a sort of adventure. It's a special profession. It's a special approach. Everything is very special, very responsible, and very attractive at the same time. And, of course, when you start your career, you understand what for you do it. Of course, you can make state propaganda in Russia, in the United States, in France, and everywhere. It's your free choice. Or you can make your investigations, and you can be opponent of power or opponent of some businesses and so on. It's your free choice. But if you are a real, honest journalist, you should serve your audience, your readers, listeners, and so on. And sometimes it's a tough job. And what I should say now, we have very different journalisms in Russia. Of course, on one hand, I remember very well, and I have been working for the most avant-garde publication of Perestroika time for Oganyok, Little Flame magazine. And it was really time of exciting emotions and time of open and big world, our past, future, international affairs, and so on. It was wonderful. And we felt more or less free. Of course, we didn't expect censorship from economy, from market, for example, which we immediately got after market came. We have no official censorship. It's a big achievement. But, of course, when we look at our national TV channels, we see that they're the same boring stuff because they represent usually the only position which is very close to official governmental position on all issues. It's not because of censorship. It's because free choice of their directors and managers, because it's more convenient for them to be nice to the power. It's their choice. But at the same time, you can look at Moscow original publications, independent publications, and see very strong and sharp critic on everything, on presidential administration, President Putin himself, all our authorities, all our businesses, and so on. So you can publish everything in Russia. It's a real achievement. You are free to do it. Of course, audience of state national channels, it's much bigger. At the same time, you still have, you can put your your text on internet, and you will get response. Another thing is that, of course, you can publish everything, but you are not sure that anybody will react. Mm-hmm. So you can publish investigation with all proofs, and you cannot be sure that your hero will be put into jail, for example, or even to court. It's another question, but it's a question in our society. There is a real problem to get information from some sources, from some governmental structures. It's a hot issue, access to information. Another question is, I think, question of our journalist community, cooperation inside our community, and our ability to struggle with pressure, because I think that journalists face pressure, everybody, from power, from businesses, from different parts of society and so on. But in some countries, journalists can resist. They can protect their rights. They can protect their rights to be journalists, to do their jobs. I think in Russia, we're very fresh in democracy. We have no experience. We're just in the very beginning. And it's a pity that our journalists lost, I should say, in some ways. But it's our responsibility. It's not just governmental pressure. Because pressure from government, I think it's ubiquitous. Every power would like to control the media. It's every day. It's obvious. But if media is strong, if media is real force, there is a discussion, which means that in that situation you have civil society. In Russia, it is problematical. But I think I agree with Pavel Gutiontov that in some extent it's more difficult now. But it means that we must work more as journalists.
Mm. We have some other callers here. Let's talk with them. Someone here locally in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. Would you repeat the period of time you suggested that 250 journalists were killed over? I didn't quite catch that. Over the last...
Thank you. It was since 1991, since the collapse of Soviet Union. Russian Union of Journalists had this survey, and unfortunately, we know all the names, and I should say that we try to support their families, their children, their relatives, and unfortunately, owners of big media, because mostly those people were sent to business trips by their media, they do not take care of those people.
Is the caller still there? Well, we lost him, I guess, and I apologize if that was something that we did. If he would like to call back, he can do that and follow up. I wonder if you could talk just a little bit about what the circumstances were of these of the death of these journalists and who would be believed to be responsible.
It's a good question. For example, one of them is my university mate, Vlad Listev. He was one of director of ORT, its first national public television. He was killed just 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Of course, because of his journalist activities, he wanted to change business strategy of the channel. Unfortunately, there was a long, long investigation. It was a symbolic murder. It was like a first murder of independent media leader, not just a journalist. He was a well-known journalist. And he created his talk show a little bit like Larry King's show. He repeated his style. It was very innovative 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when he decided to change advertisement policy in this channel, he was killed immediately. So everybody understood it was a business thing. It was a murder. But unfortunately, guilty is not found yet. And it's a typical murder. Many of them were killed during the investigations. They were shooted. They were beaten. And it happens. And we have reports from our Center for Extreme Journalism, and almost every day we got information that journalists are threatened, beaten, face different types of violence because of their investigations. And I should say that it's more tougher in small towns than in Moscow. Moscow is huge. You are free to criticize president, parliament, everybody. We have several hundreds of publications just in Moscow. And it's very big destination between you and Kremlin, for example. But when you live in a small town, when mayor and all authorities are close to you and your family, it's sometimes more dangerous. Mm-hmm. But people are honest enough, and I am glad to say that our colleagues are courage and honest enough to continue those investigations about corruption in those small towns and so on.
I think we got that caller back. I just wanted to make sure that if he had some other questions that...
Appreciate it.
Yeah, sure.
I wanted to ask specifically about the Russian-American Khlebnikov. I noticed that the case has been dropped, mm-hmm. and that they're saying that it was a Chechen, whereas the reporting here, and I don't know how reliable it is, suggests that his major book was about a oligarch.
Berezovsky, yes.
Yeah, and that it's more likely, and it seems odd that Putin, who is, you know, trying to look like he's cracking down on the oligarchs, is ready to drop the case and say it's a terrorism case, and we don't have to proceed other than through that usual fashion. So I don't know how many people actually know about the case of this financial reporter who's...
Khlebnikov is well known. Mm-hmm. He was in the center of our discussion, and when he was killed, of course, it was one of the most important news, and investigation is not finished yet. Many people were asked about it, and I do not know. I have no idea when it could be finished and what will happen, but it's under control of our prosecutor, and of course it's an awful case.
What I'm saying is I just saw a short blurb in The Guardian suggesting mm-hmm. that the case had been closed by the state, and they were saying that it was done by a Chechen, and therefore I'm not sure. I guess I should have read to the bottom of the article. Maybe the case is still open, but that was their byline, their short summary of the instance that was dated June 17th. But there's some other interesting reporting in The Guardian about Putin and some of his discourse. I don't know, that's kind of lighthearted to talk about after this stuff about the many journalists killed, but I don't know if you want to say there was a portrait of him and his family, but I think he said something just really, you know, over the top, which he has done a couple of times, where recently he called Africans, or alluded to their cannibalism or something, just recently. So he seems to get away with this without much editorial note. And I appreciate your efforts. Thank you.
You know, I do not have exact information about this Khlebnikov case, but I think that investigation is not finished. It wasn't announced openly that it was finished, and this or that person was announced as guilty. So, and I think it will be similar to Vlad Listev's case. For a long time, we'll not have real information. And what about, I should say that President Putin usually says good works. His definitions of our development to democratic-oriented state, his words about freedom of expression, his words about economical independence of the media, which is basis for freedom of expression, they are very good. But unfortunately, practices are very different from those statements. And economical independence of the media is a hot issue. And of course, it's a really serious problem in Russia. Media is divided between different companies, between different groups. Political and financial groups. There is a redivision of this market now. Now we are undergoing new division, new restructuring of media market. And there is very small space for really independent publications, radio stations. And we have no, unfortunately, public broadcasting in Russia. We just discuss, and Russian Union of Journalists applied to a parliament with a draft law devoted to public broadcasting, and fortunately in Moscow region and in Moscow capital and in Khanty-Mansiysk region, which is very rich oil and gas region, regional authorities decided to establish public radio as an experiment, and we are happy that we have this experience, so maybe next time we will be glad to report about
all
it.
All right, let's talk again with another listener. This would be someone here in Champaign-Urbana, someone local, line number two. Hello.
Hello, interesting. Please comment on how English is taught in Russia. For instance, after Sputnik here, there was suddenly a lot of money and interest in Russian language, Russian folk music. We started folk mm-hmm. music bands, and there was a scientist who taught herself Russian from textbooks. Apparently, we couldn't find a Russian teacher. They were very rare. and she was one of the first to teach Russian language here in the States in a high school. And then a while ago, there was a speaker from the Institute mm-hmm. in Moscow for the Study of North America, and that was standing room only. And every summer, there were 2,000 people studying here at the Russian Institute, and now the news says it's down to about 200. And just wondering how the how languages like English are taught, and is there a lot of money now for such studies in Russia? Grazie.
Oh, thank you. I'm very glad to hear that Russian language is so popular in Urbana-Champaign, and I will ask my colleagues in East European Center maybe to attract more people to those programs. That's great. And I should say that since Perestroika, it's another achievement. People had the opportunity to travel, to be in contact with foreign cultures, and interest to foreign languages is huge. And we see, for example, that almost all young boys and girls in Moscow and other big cities and even in rural areas, they can express their feelings in English, first of all, because of internet. Other languages are also rather popular. For example, French, Spanish, Italian and is very popular in Russia because of big cultural and commercial relationship with Italy. And other languages like Japanese, for example, Chinese. Japanese is very, very popular. Japan is in fashion now, and many young people, and not only young, some professionals, try to study extra language. But I should say that we will see here a generation gap. People after 30, they are not so... Maybe they are not so lazy, but they have very limited time. They earn money, they have to feed their families. But young people, they are very active. And sometimes you can get, of course, in our schools, in our universities, foreign language studies are free. And you can subscribe to some special courses. You can buy some equipment for your computer or some audio or video courses. It's very cheap, so it's available. If you would like to study foreign language, you will do it, definitely.
The Soviet Union was a superpower, no doubt about it. Russia remains a very large country, a very significant country in terms of its people, in terms of its knowledge base, in terms of its natural resources. Again, no doubt about that, but is no longer a superpower. Do you think that this is something that concerns Russians? Do they feel that somehow they, because the power of Russia has been diminished, do they feel diminished?
You know, it's not for whom how. To tell the truth, many Russians are very passive. They're not so interested in politics as before. After 20 years of perestroika, we received a population which is not interested in foreign or even domestic affairs, except economical ones. So people are more focused, maybe like in the States, so they're more focused on their private life, on their families, on their incomes, on their jobs, on their careers, on their children. On one hand, it's good, because I remember Soviet time when there was nothing to do. There was no entertainment, so there was no free press. TV was very boring and limited. And people just discussed universal problems in the kitchen, drinking tea or vodka, it depends on people. And I think it was not so natural. Some people really feel humiliated, mostly people from elder generation, who used to discuss world problems during Soviet time, listening to BBC, to Voice of America, to Radio Liberty. So it was practice of their life to discuss universal international problems. And they were more familiar with the political leaders, for example, of the states of Europe, that their local authorities. They feel humiliated. They feel that Gorbachev, for example, was guilty for destroying the superpower. But people, to tell the truth, they're not so interested in international politics. And what is a pity that people, Russia is more open country than Soviet Union, but unfortunately we have no real information about real people's life. And I think it's media fault as well. For example, if we ask ordinary Russian person, with university degree. What is like in life in the States is about? They had no idea. Because real information about Americans, I think, I guess that many Americans have no idea about Russian life as well.
I'm sure that that's true.
But it's a pity. I think that people's relationship is more stable and more natural than relationship of politicians, because it's real, it's stable, it's our lifetime. And I think we can do our best to give our readers, our audience, more information about real life of real people. Suffering is very often exaggerated, I should say, especially in Russia, because Russia has a culture of suffering. Our great literature, our tradition, and our tragic history, of course, give origins for this culture of suffering. But at the same time, people can enjoy everyday life. They have great sense of humor. They have their own strategies, not just to survive in this very complicated situation, but to have normal life. They elaborate new values, and they are good people, not like gangsters, oligarchs, or suffering pensioners, or poor women. They're very different. And I should say that if we knew more about each other, maybe our life would be more perfect, more interesting.
Mm. We're coming down to the point where we have maybe 4 or 5 minutes. I have mentioned a couple of times that you were here to take part in the symposium that's looking at the life of women in Russia. And one of the specific things that people are going to be focusing on is the issue of trafficking in women and children. And this is something that we have, you know, in Western media, we certainly have heard about, particularly in the case of women either being taken physically or being misled and suddenly find themselves in some place where they're literally captive and ending up being sex slaves in a very real sense. Just how significant a problem is this?
Oh, yes, it is significant. Unfortunately, it is understood and it is discussed now on all levels in Russia. But Russia is a country of trafficking both ways. First of all, approximately 500,000 women every year is trafficked to and from Russia. Women from Central Asia, from all former Soviet countries are trafficked to Russia. And Russian women are sent and sold to Western Europe, to East, West, not so often to the States. And not long ago, we had a presentation of very interesting international research conducted by International Center for Organized Crime. Headquarters is in American University in Washington, D.C., and there are different headquarters in Eastern Europe and three in Russia. It was focused on Russia, Ukraine, and the States. It was very useful because this survey showed the links between trafficking in women and international organized crime. And it was very important to understand this phenomenon as a part of international organized crime. And scholars participated in this survey were very serious. They are from law field, from economy, from psychology, from criminology, and so on. So it is discussed, and it's discussed in our media. And fortunately, our authorities are discussing our special legislation devoted to trafficking in people.
Yeah. I think perhaps we are going to, we have one more caller. We'll see if we can accommodate them in the time that remains. This is someone listening in Champaign and line one.
Thank you.
Yes.
That last issue, very important. Glad to hear that. This is a little different. My background is in nursing, and I was in Moscow in probably 66, 67, somewhere in there, accompanying my husband to a scientific conference. So I did some tours, and although felt very free and safe, did see, you know, the suppression. But one thing I was impressed with was that in talking, you know, to tour guides while the rest were talking science, you know, I got to talk with people like that, and very impressed with how many women were physicians and those kinds of and could go into that kind of work because they did have wonderful daycares and got that kind of support. And I realized that's a long time ago, and things have changed. But I wondered if you would comment a little bit on women in those professions and what kind of numbers, and if they still have that support of daycare and so forth.
Thank you for this question. Really, we have, I think, the largest number, the largest percentage in the world of women physicians, teachers, engineers, mathematicians, and so on, and now journalists. But it's, first of all, because of low payment for these professions. And second, yes, since Perestroika, and especially not since Perestroika, but since market economy, situation has changed. We have now less women in labor market. Many people were fired because of market reforms and restructuring of Russian economy. And we unfortunately have no enough free daycare centers. Daycare centers are more expensive now, not available for everybody. And women suffer of lack of real social and health care for themselves and for their children. But some small enterprises began to appear in this field as well. And we face now change of whole state policy and politics towards women. And women are not understand as very serious players in newborn Russian market, and it should be improved.
Well, we're, I am sorry to say, at the point we're going to have to stop because we've used our time. But I do again want to thank our guest, Nadia Ajgikina. She's a journalist and an activist on gender issues in Russia. She teaches journalism at Moscow State University and currently serves as the executive secretary of the Russian Union of Journalists and has been a journalist now for quite some time. She's here visiting the campus for a forum sponsored by the Russian East European and Eurasian Center about women in Russia today. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.